Okay, so you notice I'm wearing a mask again. It's not because I'm sick, nor because there's a big surge in Stillwater. Rather, it's because I have friends that are coming from France next week, and we're both trying to keep things safe for their visit. So, hope you don't mind this. What we'll do today is review for the second exam, and I'll start by reviewing the two topics that are basically the substance of the exam. Linear subspaces, which are special sets that are of relevance to linear algebra, and linear transformations, which are the functions that are relevant to linear algebra. But then, of course, those are the two main topics, but attached to these are a bunch of subspaces, and what we need to understand in order to use subspaces is how to coordinatize them. And that's where the other topics, like the notion of bases and linear independence, comes in. But in the end, when you actually take the exam, what you'll find, if you look at the practice exam, you're basically most of the, aside from knowing the definitions, most of your problems are just going to be recognizing what subspace we're talking about, and then the procedure by which we find a basis for that subspace. Okay, so let me go over the topics first. So we're working with vectors all the time in this course, but what we specialize to now are special subsets of vectors in a vector space. Let's say I have a bunch of vectors and I put them in a set called W. Requirement we want for interesting sets is that with respect to the two fundamental vector space operations, these sets should be well behaved, meaning that if I add two vectors inside this set, I should stay inside the set, just like if I add two three-dimensional vectors, I stay inside a three-dimensional space. And similarly, we'll want it to behave well with respect to scalar multiplication. So more precisely, what we need is that if we start off with a number, any vector inside the set, once we do the scalar multiplication, we're still inside that set. Or if we take a sum of two vectors that start off living in that set, we combine them together to produce a new vector, that new vector stays inside that set. So the sets of vectors that have those two properties are called subspaces. And they're the fundamental objects in linear algebra. And so once I introduced subspaces, the next thing I did is try to describe how we talk about individual vectors that live inside a subspace. Typically, these are going to be lower dimensional surfaces embedded inside a larger dimensional space. So if a subspace, which is typically a hyperplane that passes through the origin, if it's of lower dimension than the space in which it lives, then the original coordinates are not really apt for describing points in it. If I had a two-dimensional surface embedded in a 10-dimensional space, I don't want to have to use 10 parameters to find all the vectors on that two-dimensional surface. So what the basis idea of a basis is, and it's you can think about a number of different ways. The main purpose of it is to find good coordinates for the vectors that live inside a subspace. But what they represent are independent directions that live inside that space. You need enough independent directions so you can reach every point on this in the subspace, but you want to use these guys to get coordinates. So not only do you need to reach every point in your subspace, you want to make sure there's a unique way of getting it, because that's how we're going to get coordinates. So more precisely, I got my pointer in here somewhere. Maybe not. Well, more precisely, what we need is that effectively two conditions. First of all, you have to be able to reach every vector in your subspace by taking linear combination. And moreover, you want these numbers, C1 through CK, the coefficients of such an expansion, you want those to be unique. Because the idea then is going to use these K numbers rather than the dimension of the original vectors, you use these K numbers as coordinate for the elements that live inside a subspace. All right, now this definition reflects what we're going to use a basis for. We use bases to coordinatize subspaces. But there are really two separate conditions. One is to make sure you can write every vector this way, and separately, that they're unique. And it's actually this uniqueness property that makes them useful for finding coordinates. And then distinct from this, or at least it would seem so initially, is this notion of linear independence. All right, forget about bases. If you simply have a set of vectors, and the only way you can get them to add to zero is by taking all the coefficients are equal to zero, we say that the vectors are linearly independent. Now, this is a nice mathematical condition to check. It's a single equation for which we should have a solution. So this can be checked mathematically. And in fact, what it's telling you is that the vectors you start off with are really point in independent directions. Just think about two vectors. If I have two vectors and they're parallel, well, then I can get them to cancel one another. I just point the vectors in the opposite direction and they'll end up canceling. But if they actually point in different directions, multiplying one vector by a number just makes it longer, shorter. Maybe it reverses its direction, but it doesn't change its direction. And multiplying another vector by a number makes it longer or shorter, potentially reverses its direction, but it doesn't stop it from being independent of the other direction. So what this condition is really saying is that these guys are really independent directions. And so what you can do is effectively you can replace this second condition by demanding that these coefficients are unique. If these guys are independent directions, then you're already guaranteed that these coefficients are going to be unique. There won't be any way to get them to cancel if this condition is true. So the way to understand bases is that they provide coordinates, and the way you understand linear independence, this is the way you check to make sure that you really have independent directions for which to build your space. All right, now, once we have a set of vectors that's sufficient to generate the space, and I also know they represent independent directions, then in fact, I know those vectors are also a basis. So I think the way the textbook defines a basis is they say it's a set of vectors that generate a space and are linearly independent. And then what they do is they prove that the coefficients in an expansion of any vector in this set in terms of these vectors is always unique. So they kind of reverse my logic. My logic is to get the coordinates first and then introduce linear independence as a simple way to check to make sure you have independent directions. But other textbooks and other lecturers will say, well, we'll start off with these two conditions as a definition of what a basis is, and then we'll prove that the expansion is unique. For the exam, stick to the way I'm doing it. The definition of a basis is every vector can be in the subspace can be represented as a linear combination. And second of all, that linear combination is unique. That will give us coordinates. And then just understand this notion of linear independence. It's a way to check to make sure that you really have independent directions. Okay. And then some other things to know about bases is, first of all, anytime you have a subspace, it's guaranteed to have some basis. And in fact, every basis for it is going to have the same number of vectors. Think of three-dimensional space. There's three independent directions you need to get a basis for a three-dimensional space. But you have many different choices for how you orient your coordinate axes. Those would all correspond to choices of bases, but the number of vectors, in any way, is going to stay the same. And the number of vectors that you require for a basis is actually what we refer to as the dimension of the space. So three-dimensional space, there's three distinct directions, up, maybe sideways, and in and out. Those three independent directions will generate the space. and they give us the dimension of our face. All right, now, thus far, I've given you, well, one theorem that relates some definitions, but everything else has been definition. On the exam, you will be required to state definitions. So there's a practice exam posted. You'll see the definitions presented there in the solutions. I'm also presenting the definitions here on these lecture slides. What I want to stress to you is that you're going to need to know these definitions verbatim. What I suggest you do is take 15 minutes sometime over the weekend and make sure you can reproduce these definitions without looking at any notes. And you can copy the verbiage exactly as I write it. That way, that 15 minutes of effort will guarantee you maybe 25 points on the exam. It's very important for me that you understand these definitions and are not sort of using the many different ways, many different applications of these definitions, that you can actually distinguish an application of a definition from the definition itself. So, for example, this theorem in this course is not a definition. Once we know what a basis is, as defined on the preceding slide, this turns out to be a consequence of the definitions. So, stepping back a little bit, I'll show you in a minute when we actually look at the practice exam. I'll show you what you would need to do to answer questions on definitions. But we're almost through the material to be covered. Once we had the notion of subspaces, then I tried to give you examples of subspaces, in particular ones that we can calculate. So I have given you three subspaces that one can attach to any matrix. So you start off with an n by n matrix, and then we can get subspaces from this matrix three different ways, depending on how we think about this matrix. We can think of it as a bunch of coefficients put in slots. We can think of it as a collection of row vectors or as a collection of column vectors. And depending on how we're thinking about that matrix, we get different subspaces. For example, the row space. Think of the matrix as being a bunch of row vectors, and then just take all possible linear combinations of those row vectors. That's going to create a subspace. Typical way you create a subspace is just by taking the span of a given list of vectors. But notice that now this subspace, because every row is going to have exactly m elements in it, count one to m, you're going to end up with a bunch of vectors that are all m-dimensional vectors. So we get a subspace of Rm. Thinking about the matrix as a collection of columns, we get a different subspace, and it lives in a different vector space. It's still constructed in essentially the same way by taking all possible linear combinations of my column vectors, but now my columns, each column has exactly n entries. So these are all n-dimensional vectors, and so my subspace will live in Rn. Now, what you have to understand about these guys is not only what they are, but how do we find a basis for these two subspaces? Well, what we've seen is a single row reduction calculation will yield the answer to both. The way you get a basis for this row space is you take the matrix and you row reduce it to a row echelon form. Now, what might happen during that row reduction process is some zero rows get created. Because rows end up canceling with one another when you try to remove pivots. Well, you ignore the zero rows in the row echelon form. You grab only the non-zero rows, and those vectors will give you a basis for this row space. For the column space, you can use the same row reduction process, but the way you get the basis vectors is different. For the column space, you row reduce the matrix to a row echelon form, you look at where the pivots live. Then the pivots, what you do is you transport them back to the original matrix and you grab the columns. So if my row echelon form, for example, had a pivot in the third column, that would mean the third column of the original matrix was actually a basis vector for the column space. And you get all the basis vectors that way, all the basis vectors for the column space. Then there's a third way of thinking about this matrix, and that is as the coefficient matrix for a linear system. And when you think about the matrix that way, this matrix is actually being all the coefficients of some system of linear equations in a variable x. Well, the solution set of this homogeneous linear system is going to be a subspace, and it's called the null space of the corresponding matrix. The way we get a basis for that subspace is we can actually use the same row reduction calculation described on the preceding slide. You take the matrix, you row reduce to row echelon form. But in this case, because you actually want the solution, you have to row reduce all the way to reduce row echelon form. And so in fact, you actually have to solve this linear system in order to find the basis for this set. What it is once you've written down the solution of this equation, it's a hyperplane. So you've got this solution expressed as a bunch of free parameters times constant vectors. You just grab those constant vectors that occur in that expansion, and those will be the basis vectors for your null space. All right, so let me see if I can do a quick example. Suppose A equals 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1. Let me put another row in there. Yeah, there was a question? Oh, okay. So suppose this matrix, and here's the big supposition, because I'm not going to do the computation. Suppose this row reduced to 0, 0, 0. Suppose it row reduced to that. Probably not. But I just want to start with a matrix. And this is, suppose that's the row echelon form of the matrix I started off with. The way I would get bases for the row space, the column space, and the null space, given this calculation, would be as follows. First of all, the row space of A, it's the non-zero rows in the row echelon form. So it's just going to consist of 1, 0, 1, 1, comma, and then 0, 1, 0, 0. All right, then that will be a basis for the row space. These two vectors are going to generate the entire row space, and they're linearly independent. All right, so that's a basis for one subspace. The basis for the column space, well, the same calculation is done, except what we do once we reach it is different. For the column space, you look at where the pivots live, and then you go back to the original matrix and grab the corresponding columns. And so this is, for this given matrix, it's just going to be, well, here's a pivot. I go back to the original matrix and I grab that column, 1, 2, 0. Here's a pivot living in the row echelon form. I go back to the original matrix and I grab the corresponding column. All right. And there's a basis for the column space. One more subspace, the null space of the matrix. But what I have to do is I actually have to solve AX is equal to 0. Well, we're more than halfway to the solution once we've done this row reduction. So all we have to do is complete the solution of this, writing down the solution of this equation using this matrix in reduced row echelon form. So this matrix tells me that x1 plus x3 plus x4 is going to have to equal 0. That's sort of reading off the equation that would come from the first row. Second row is going to tell me that x2 has to equal 0. And then we still haven't written down the solution yet. We want to write it as a hyperplane. So I use the form of the augmented matrix in reduced row echelon form to identify the three variables. It's going to be, in this example, x3 and x4, because those are columns that don't contain pivots. That's going to suggest that I express the variables that correspond to columns with pivots, the fixed variables, they're going to be expressed as minus x3 minus x4, just moving the free variables to the right-hand side. And here we'll still have x2 is equal to 0. All right, now that I've utilized the equations coming from the augmented matrix in reduced row echelon form, I write down a solution vector. Now I guess I'll do it up here. X is going to equal let's see, its first component has to be equal minus x3 minus x4. Its second component has to equal 0. And the third and fourth components, they're free parameters, so I'll leave them at that. And then when the last thing I do is I expand in terms of the free parameters, minus 1, 0, 1, 0, and plus x4, minus 1, 0, 0, 1. All right, then these two vectors, these constant vectors that are being multiplied by the free parameter, they're the basis vectors for the null space. So that null space is actually equal to the span of, looks like minus 1, 0, 1, 0, and minus 1, 0, 0, 1. And so these are your basis vectors. All right. So any questions on that? Being able to take a matrix and finding basis for both its row space, column space, and null space, that's really the principal calculation that you have to do on the exam. And then there's one more definition to know, and that is, subspaces are very special functions, or subspaces are special sets that are relevant to linear algebra. Linear transformations are the functions that are relevant to linear algebra. They are functions between two vector spaces that behave naturally with respect to scalar multiplication and vector addition. Here are the rules. Whether I scalar multiply a vector before I apply the function or after I apply the function, I should get the same result. Or whether I add vectors before I map over into the new vector space, or after I move over to the new vector space, I should get the same result. Now, most functions are not going to have that property, but if they do, we call it a linear transformation. And it turns out that these are the notion of a function that's most relevant to linear algebra. Now, in fact, one way to create a function that has those properties is just to use matrix multiplication. And so in fact, if you have a matrix, A, say it's an n by m matrix, well, an n by m matrix can multiply a column vector with m components. Because if you have this match between inner dimensions, an n by m matrix times an n by 1 column vector, that multiplication is defined, and it's going to produce a matrix that has n rows in one column as a result. Well, what you can do is take an m-dimensional vector, and the result is going to be an n-dimensional vector. And so, given a matrix, you have a way of going from m-dimensional vectors to n-dimensional vectors. And in fact, it's a linear transformation of this sort. And the way you would find it, let's remove the t here, you would define a linear transformation via matrix multiplication. Now, this theorem says that the opposite is also true. If you can not only use a matrix to define a linear transformation, but a linear transformation, you can define a matrix that basically reproduces the action of that function, but it does so via matrix multiplication rather than by evaluation at a particular point. And so what it also does is allows us to transport questions about linear transformations between vector spaces. We can now deal with them through the use of this numerical matrix. It's just going to be a bunch of numbers enclosed inside square braces. So it's going to be naturally a thing we can apply addition and subtraction and do calculations with. While this, to understand these function between two vector spaces, you focus more on the variables rather than just a matrix of numbers. So the idea of this matrix A subscript T, the matrix that corresponds to a linear transformation, is so that we have a calculable model for which to understand functions between between vector spaces. And we use that matrix. Let me write it out in its functional form. So if you have, if T is going from an m-dimensional space to an n-dimensional space, and it's a linear transformation, here's how you construct the associated matrix. You let, the T is going to act on m-dimensional vectors. So let's apply it to the first standard basis vector of this m-dimensional space. Well, you'll get an answer. It's going to be an n-dimensional vector. But write the answer out vertically. That will get the dimensions of this matrix to be appropriate. It'll end up being a matrix with as many columns as we have dimensions here, and as many rows as we have dimensions here. The last one is going to be T applied to the last standard basis vector of this domain. And we take the answer and we write it vertically. That gives us a concrete numerical matrix that basically contains all the information and, in fact, allows us to reproduce the action of this linear transformation using this matrix. This matrix is going to have the property that whatever T does to an m-dimensional vector can be replicated by regarding this m-dimensional vector as a column vector and then multiplying it by this matrix. So you have that relationship. Okay. So the last thing we did is we defined some subspaces attached to a linear transformation. These subspaces were not defined using algebraic ideas, linear algebraic ideas. Rather, we're using function theory ideas. So the first one was the range of a linear transformation. And now that was defined in a sort of function theoretic way. What we do if you have a linear transformation from an m-dimensional space to an n-dimensional space, what we can do is collect together all the points in the codomain that can be reached by applying this function. So you want y to equal t applied to x for some vector that lives inside the domain Rm. And once this was defined, it was immediately verified that it's also a subspace. It's closed under scalar multiplication and vector addition. A second subspace was the kernel of a linear transformation. It was defined using function theory as a set of points, this time in the domain, place where we start off, and the condition we want is that we want the vectors in the domain that get sent to the zero vector in the codomain, Rn. So we want all the points whose value, when we apply this function to it, end up being the zero vector. All right, so these two sets are defined using function theory, seeing how where the function takes points. But they're calculable because each of these subspaces can be calculated using the auxiliary matrix. This range is exactly the same thing as the column space of the associated matrix. And we know by this formula how to compute that matrix. And then from the preceding discussion about subspaces associated with matrices, we know how to find a basis for the column space. And similarly, this kernel it's a subspace defined by the way T acts as a function, but it corresponds to the same set of vectors as the null space of the associated matrix. And so the calculation that we did to find bases for column space and null spaces of matrices is now can also be used to find bases for subspaces that are now attached to a linear transformation rather than the matrix. But what would we do? If we wanted to know what the range of a linear transformation is, first thing I would do is I would calculate this matrix. Then I would take that matrix and I would row reduce it to reducer echelon form, figure out where the pivots live, go back to the original matrix and grab those columns. And now I have a basis not only for the column space, but a basis for this subspace associated with the linear transformation thought of purely on functional terms. And similarly for the kernel, once we want to find a basis for this kernel, we calculate the associated matrix and then use the matrix calculation to figure out a basis for this null space. All right, so that's basically what you're going to be doing on this exam. Identifying subspaces, you'll have to I'll usually state what they are, but you're going to have to figure out how to find bases. And typically what that's going to involve is you find a matrix, you row reduce, and then depending on which subspace attached to that matrix you're interested in, you'll either grab the non-zero rows for the row space, grab the columns of the original matrix corresponding to pivots of a row echelon form to get a basis for the column space. And for the kernel, you actually have to solve the linear system A subscript T of X is equal to zero. All right, so that's the material that we've covered. Let me, let me restart my share screen. Hold on just a second here. Okay, what I'm going to put up is a practice exam. I'll try to do as much of this as I can. Let me just quickly go over the first page. So what you see on the practice exam, and I promise you what you'll see on the exam on Monday is probably identical to that on the first part. I want you to memorize those definitions and be able to write them down verbatim. And in fact, what version do I want you to write? Let me show you. All right, so here's the posted solutions to the practice exam. So for a subspace, remember that you need to be able to, you simply have to state that it's closed under scalar multiplication and vector addition. And here are the two conditions that you're going to have to write down to make sure that I understand exactly what you mean by closure under scalar multiplication and vector addition. Start with a number and a vector. You do the scalar multiplication, you have to stay inside the set. Start with two vectors, begin living in that, you add it together, you have to stay inside that set. Here's the definition of a basis. Here's the definition of linear independent. So for this this first problem on the final exam, simply practice that you can actually replicate these definitions, and that will then you'll get full credit on those. The second problem, let's look at it. This might, the first time you see a question like this on the exam, you might be shocked, but it's really not that hard. All I'm asking you in that second problem is to figure out if the unit circle satisfies these conditions. Is it a subspace? So if I take a number and an element on the circle, and I do the scalar multiplication, do I stay on the circle? If that's always true, and moreover, whenever I add vectors on the circle, I stay on the circle. If that were always true, then it would be a subspace. But in fact, this example, it's a counterexample to a subspace. It fails to be closed under scalar multiplication, and it fails to be closed under vector addition. And showing either one of those conditions, showing that if you have a vector and a number and you do the scalar multiplication, you end up outside the set. Well, if that happens, then it can't be a subset. Or if you add two vectors that live in that live inside the subset, and you end up with a vector that lives outside that set, it's not going to be a subspace. So what you could do in this present example is show that you take a number like 0, and you take a vector b like 1, 0. Well, that lives inside this set, right? Because 1 squared plus 0 squared is going to equal 1. And that's the condition. The sum of the squares of the components has to be equal to 1 to live inside this set. 1 squared plus 0 squared does equal 1. And that's why I know that this vector lives inside the set. Okay, so I get a number, a vector. Let's do the scalar multiplication. Well, it's going to equal the 0 vector. But now, when I sum the squares of the components here, I get 0, not 1. So this new vector doesn't satisfy the condition to live inside this subset. So scalar multiplication has taken me outside of S. So S is not closed under scalar multiplication. And that means S is not a subspace. But you could have argued differently. You could also have started with, say, B1 equals 1, 0. B2 is equal to 0, 1. Notice that 1 squared plus 0 squared equals 1. So it's inside S. And in this case, 0 squared plus 1 squared equals 1. So it's the vector lives inside this subset. But when I add them together, I get a vector with two non-zero components. And 1 squared plus 1 squared does not equal 1. It equals 2 rather than 1. And so B1 plus B2 is not in S. And so I can either show that S is not closed under scalar multiplication. That would be sufficient to show that it's not a subspace. Or I could start off with two vectors that live inside S, show that when I add them, I get a vector that lives outside S, and then I've also proved that it's not a subspace. So you don't necessarily have to prove both. If as soon as you find that this property is not being, either property is not satisfied, then you know it's not a subspace. All right, so a problem like 2 on the exam may look unfamiliar with it. I don't know if there were any WebAssign problems that had you do this explicitly, but it should be simple enough to do. And then, let's see. Sorry, let me go back to the practice exam. Another problem that might look unfamiliar at first is this third problem where I ask you to find a basis for a subspace, but that subspace is not stated as a row space, a column space, or a null space of a matrix, nor is it related to any particular linear transformation. How do I find a basis for a subspace I create by simply taking a set of vectors and taking all possible linear combinations of them? Well, the idea is that even though the subspace is not the row space of a matrix, we can interpret it that as long as we interpret these three vectors as row vectors. So what you do for problem, what is that, problem 3? What you do is you form the matrix. I'll call it A. And what I'll use for its rows is the given list of vectors. So 1, 1, 1, 1 minus 2, 1. And 3, 0, 3, I guess. Because the row space of A is exactly the same thing as the span of these three vectors. Or let me just use the notation of the problem. It's going to be exactly equal to W. It's just the span of these three row vectors. So what I do to answer problem three is I find a basis for the row space of this matrix, meaning I row reduce it to a row echelon form, and I grab the non-zero row. So the answer, the question, by row reducing the matrix to a row echelon form and grabbing the non-zero rows. So in the solutions, I've done that. If I've got my solutions here, that matrix really rapidly row reduces to this. 1, 1, 1, 0, minus 3, 0, 0, 0, 0. I think just two row operations. You'll clear out this pivot, you'll clear out this pivot, and I think you're already at this matrix. This is in row echelon form, and that's sufficient. You really only need to reach row echelon form to get a basis for the row space. And so here you're non-zero rows, 1, 1, 1, 0, minus 3, 0. And so a basis for this space is going to be the same thing as the basis for the row space of this matrix, which is just going to be, I'll write it this way, the span of 1, 1, 1, and 0, minus 3, 0. And those are your basis vectors. All right. So let's see. I guess the next problem on the exam, let me see. I have 8 minutes left. Let me skip this problem. We may come back to this one in the end. I want to do I guess problems 5 and 6. So in problem 5, you're to show that T going from an M-dimensional space to an N-dimensional space via T of X equals A of X is a linear transformation. All you have to do is make sure that the properties of a linear transformation hold when a function is defined by matrix multiplication. So for example, to show that T of lambda X is equal to lambda of TX, that's what we'd want to check, that it's compatible with scalar multiplication. So what you would do is you would calculate both sides. This would be T times lambda, or actually what the function does is it does matrix multiplication. So it's going to be A times lambda X. On the right-hand side, we have A times lambda times X, right? So do the matrix multiplication before I apply the scalar multiplication, or I do the scalar multiplication before I multiply by the matrix. But either way, this is true, because matrix multiplication always commutes with scalar multiplication. And second of all, you'd want to show that T of X plus y, does that equal the same thing as T of x plus T of y? Well, just write down both sides. This is going to be the matrix A applied to the sum of vectors x plus y. And here we have A applied to x, and we're adding to it a times y. Well, this is also true because matrix multiplication always distributes over sums of vectors. So that's true. And now by following the chain of equalities, you've got the, you've proved the identity. And you won't have to do, so this problem is just, it's just writing down, using this formula, writing down both sides of the equation and then observing that it's true. Okay. All right. And then, let me do explicitly the last problem. Here, in the last problem on the exam, we're given a linear transformation that's going from a four-dimensional space to a two-dimensional space. It's taking a vector with components x1, x2, x3, x4, and it's sending it to a new vector with two components being x1 minus x3 plus 2x4, I think, and then 2x3 minus 2x4. All right, so in this problem, which I guess is number six, there's three subproblems. One is we're going to find the matrix associated with this linear transformation, and then we're going to find bases for its range and its null and its kernel. So here's the matrix. What I'm going to do is I'm going to apply this function to each of the standard basis vectors for R4. Okay, so what happens when I choose the first standard basis vector, E1, where components zero, only the first component is non-zero. When I apply T to this vector, I'll get one in the first component plus zero plus zero. In the second component, I'm going to get zero minus two times zero plus zero. So I'm going to get that. All right, so very important here, even though it looks like I should be seeing where this vector goes after substituting in numerical values and computing the resulting vector, the thing that you have to remember to do on the exam is to write the result as a vertical vector, not as a horizontal vector. But now we can do the same for each of the other standard basis vectors. The second one will be what x2 is 1, and the other components are equal to 0. So what we'll get is 0 minus 0, 2. And in the second component, right below, it's going to be 2 minus 0 plus 0. Third component, it's going to be where x3 is the only non-zero entry. What we'll get is, let's see, minus 1 in the first component, minus 2 in the second component. And then we have the last standard basis vector where only x4 is non-zero, and we'll get 2, because x4 is 1 in this case, and 1. All right, so that's how rapidly you can calculate the associated matrix. To complete this problem, you're asked to find bases for the range of that linear transformation. And you're also asked for a basis for the kernel of that linear transformation. All right, now, what happens is the range is the same thing as the column space of the associated matrix. And the kernel of the linear transformation is the same thing as the column space of the associated matrix. So to finish the problem, we're going to have to row reduce this matrix to reducial echelon form, and then from that calculation, grab the vectors corresponding to a basis for the column space and the vectors corresponding to a basis for the, this should be the null space of the matrix. Okay. So let's do that real quickly. I think this matrix It's quickly going to reduce to 1, 2, minus 1, 2. Simply divide this. Did I do that correctly? I should have 0 here, right? Yeah. Yeah, because x2 doesn't occur in the first component here. So that should have been 0 there. All right, so that's really nice, because now as soon as I divide the second row by 2, 0, 1, minus 1, 1 half, I've got it, sorry, and this is 0 here, I've got a matrix in reduced row echelon form. So that equals the reduced row echelon form of A. So as I promised, on the exam, the row reduction should be really simple. But now, to find a basis for this column space, we look at where the columns live in the reduced row echelon form, or look where the pivots live. I guess it's these two guys. This column and this column, they both contain leading non-zero entries in a row. So these are the pivot columns. I go back to the original matrix and I grab the corresponding columns. So what I'm going to get here is the basis for column space, and that's going to be the same thing as here are the pivots. Go back to the original column, I'll grab that guy, 1, 0. And here's a pivot. Go back to the original matrix and grab the corresponding column, 0, 2. All right, and there's your basis. For the null space, what we have to do is, once we've reached this matrix in reduced row echelon form, we still have to solve the linear system, A subscript Tx is equal to 0. But we've done most of the calculation. We've done all the row reduction we need to do. This first row tells me that x1 minus x3 plus 2x4 has to equal 0. And the second row tells me that x2 minus x3 plus 1 half x4 has to equal 0. That's going from the augmented, effectively the augmented matrix of the solution to the actual equations of the solution. Then we also use this matrix to interpret the variables that correspond to columns with pivots as fixed variables that can be expressed in terms of the remaining variables, x3 and x4. So what you do, as we did on the first exam, is you use the equations to express fixed variables in terms of free variables. X2 is going to equal x3 minus 1 half x4. And then once you have these equations, you write down a solution vector. And that solution vector is going to be x equals, well, for x1, we can use x3 minus 2x4. For the second component, we can use x3 minus 1 half x4. And then the third and fourth components are free variables. The last step is then to expand this solution vector in terms of the free parameters. 1, 1, 1, 0 plus x4 times minus 2, minus 1 half, 0, and 1. Then here are your basis vectors. They're basis vectors because, first of all, every solution vector can be written as a linear combination of those vectors. And second of all, these vectors are linearly independent because corresponding to this variable x3 is this component here in the first vector that can't be canceled with a corresponding entry in the second vector. So the only way I can get the third component of a vector sum like this to equal 0 is by taking x3 is equal to 0. And similarly, in order to get the fourth component to vanish when I do this sum, I have to take x4 is equal to 0. So this linear combination only produces the 0 vector when the two coefficients are equal to 0, so they're linearly independent. So I've got two vectors that generate the entire space, and they're linearly independent, so they're a basis. Okay, So the main thing you're going to need to know how to do, besides the definitions, to be able to row reduce a matrix, and those will be simple calculations, but then knowing what to do with that matrix in the end. You do different things for different subspaces. Okay, well, good luck studying this weekend, and I will see you on Monday.